The podcast you're about to listen to contains graphic details that some listeners may find disturbing. With that being said, listener discretion is advised. And if you are to proceed, buckle up, my skeptics. The story I'm going to tell you in these very trying times of racial injustice, which many believe is to be the cause of this case and the tragic death of Tamla Horsford. As someone who believes wholeheartedly in advocating for others and the black victims whose voices are often unheard, I wanted to honor this case and hopefully put a few more eyes and ears on it than it already has. It thankfully resurfaced in my life thanks to the current Black Lives Matter movement. And with that messaging of Black Lives Matter, let's get started. Tamla was a mother of five children, of whom she was very devoted to. She was a true mother trope in the sense of showing up to her kids' extracurricular activities and being very involved in the community they lived in of Forsyth, Georgia. The area was certainly one not known for its progressive nature and had a very long history of KKK members being very out and prevalent in the community, as can be seen on an episode of Oprah which aired in just 1987, in which she interviewed members of the KKK and also the town, in which she interviewed them as public attention was being drawn to the area for not a single black person had been living there in over 70 years. The city, as it can be seen in the clip, were in a very vocal disapproval of black people coming back. Confederate flags flying high, racist chants, and people in the full KKK gear and memorabilia, so it wouldn't be a shocker to assume things still were uneasy in this community, but maybe a bit more hidden in plain sight. The night of November 3rd, 2018 was a night meant for celebration, as the 40-year-old Tamla and 11 others were together at a close friend's house, planning a slumber party to drink and enjoy a birthday party of the homeowner. Out of the 11 people at this party, which consisted of 7 women and 3 men, Tamla was the only black woman there. I've been to parties or spaces before and have been the only black person there, so I honestly, from my experience, would have felt just slightly conscious of it, which I think is a natural feeling. And I especially would have that thought just being in the South where such a horrid history of racism existed. But honestly, based on the photos of her engaging in the party, she seems very happy and at ease. In most of the photo, when you're looking up this case, the party guests are seen with their faces blurred. Apparently, after the case catching widespread attention nationally, they were threatened, but the timeline of events we're going to go through, sadly, is from their lens that night. Most of the party was pretty well documented from the guests who were celebrating, at least the early moments. You see snippets of video of them singing happy birthday to the homeowner, Jeanne Myers, and can visibly see a very alive Tamla, not appearing to be overly intoxicated in those moments. But according to guests at the party, she had brought her own personal bottle of alcohol, which nobody claimed to have seen her sharing. So the implication or story being told was that she was getting very intoxicated throughout the night. The gathering with everyone, though, didn't have any reports of people getting into any altercations that night, as they all planned to watch the LSU Tigers game and socialize. In the photos, you see all the guests also wearing pajamas and onesies, as it was the theme of the night. How could such a seemingly carefree in a night amongst what was assumed friends turn fatal? That's the question still boggling my mind. It was also noted by multiple people that at this party, Tamla was the only guest to be smoking that night. In the reports, it didn't seem like they were insinuating anything other than cigarettes, but that would later be not the case. According to the toxicology report, her blood alcohol levels were reported to be 0.23, with THC and Xanax found in her system. On her possessions that she had with her, they found evidence of marijuana and rolling papers, so it would seem that can explain why it was in her system. As the night and the party had went on, guests started to leave the party. The data for exact times were taken from the security features that clock when the doors open and close and cross-reference with guests. We got an approximate situation on what was going on that night. So around 11:30 p.m., two women were noted to leave the party. 1:47 a.m., another woman leaves. It was noted at that time she saw an alive Tamil at this point. 4:10 a.m., another woman leaves to head towards work. 7:45 a.m., another woman leaves. 8:30 a.m., a couple is the last to leave before the body of Tamil is discovered at 8:45 a.m. The body is discovered, and for 14 minutes, they sat with the knowledge that this woman needed help, but didn't call the police until 8:59 a.m. Before I go off on literally every reason why that's already suspicious, I'll play a bit of the 911 call, because it gets even weirder.
Forsyth County 911.
Hi, yes, I need an ambulance and a bridge to my home.
What's the address?
4450 Woodlake Court.
4450 Woodlake?
Woodlake,
okay. All right, 4450 Woodlake Court. What is your name?
My name is Jean Myers, J-E-A-N-N-E.
Okay, and your phone number is 609?
Yes.
Okay, what's going on?
We had people over last night. We were drinking. Most of us went to bed. One of them stayed on the balcony. She was drinking, and we just went outside, and she's laying face down in the backyard. It looks like, I'm guessing maybe she fell off the balcony, but she's stiff.
Okay, is she breathing?
I don't know if she's face down.
Okay. How old is she?
At 41. Here, hold on.
Hey, this is Jose Barrera.
Hey, have y'all checked to see if she's breathing?
She's not moving one bit. She's not breathing.
Okay.
I just tried to assess her, Tesla. She's completely face down in the yard. She is stiff.
Okay. Do you know if she, do you see any blood or anything where she, my call just dropped. Are you there?
I am.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I was outside.
It's okay. I'm not sure what happened to Alana for a second. Do you see any blood or anything to where, from where she fell?
I don't know if I should move her over. I mean, she's completely face down.
Okay. I mean, can you just check and see if she's breathing? If she's not breathing and you know she's gone, then just leave her where she's at. If she... Okay.
1 minute. I'm completely not sure.
Okay, and that's the only blood that you would see?
That's what I can see without moving her over. I haven't seen her face.
Do you know if she, do you know if she was suicidal at all?
I have no clue. I've met her one other time. You know, like my girlfriend said, people were over last night. her birthday party. We're not the woman that we believe to be deceased, but it's my girlfriend's birthday party. Instead of having everybody go out, she had everyone stay in. And she was the last one I saw before everybody, I mean, everybody was typically put off to bed. She was the last one in the kitchen. She was just either waiting around for a ride or waiting until the morning.
Okay. How far is the, where she would have fell from, how far is the deck from the ground?
I would probably say, maybe 20 feet.
Okay.
You know, 20 feet from where your feet would be on the railing. The railing itself is maybe 3.5, 4 feet.
Okay. And what is her name?
I know her name. We call her Tam. I'm assuming that's short for Tammy or Tamra.
Was she there with anyone else?
Her name is Tam Horsford, H-O-R-S-F-O-R-D, so the black female. I don't believe anybody was. My girlfriend has cameras here on the back deck that we can check.
Okay.
That I think would have caught the incident if she fell from here. Again, I don't know. It's hard to say if she fell from the deck or if she was already downstairs. She was the only smoker here. And I'm sorry. There's a lot of information.
Okay, I'm so sorry about that. So you think she's possibly out there smoking?
Yeah, she was the only smoker. I mean, I'm on the back deck right now, and, you know, cigarette lighter, I tried to finger out here.
Okay.
I'm just trying to see where on her wrist kind of came from.
Okay. All right. Are all the people that were there last night, are they still at your house?
Okay. Okay, there are 4 people that were here last night that are no longer here.
Okay. And they just left this morning, or they leave last night?
Do you know roughly what time each of them left? Like, who stayed completely in and out of the city? We can check. I mean, she's got an alarm system that gives alerts when the doors are open on her phone.
Okay.
But I think the last time that I personally saw Tam was probably about 1 in the morning before I'd gone upstairs to bed.
Okay.
And at that point, she was the only one in the kitchen.
The call for me was very odd. For one, it starts with the presumed first person to have discovered the body, the homeowner, Jian, and then as she starts explaining away her opinion on what happens, which never is a good sign, the phone gets passed to her boyfriend, Jose Barrera, who just sounds as if he's having a phone call with a friend and not at all in distress. Now I know not everyone agrees the same, and we all grieve differently, but the tone just seems so off, and he didn't even really know her name or seemingly much about her. And on the call, you notice he has to get her name from what I assume to be the girlfriend, and is answering questions also that the operator is asking about Tamla's mental health. You think the phone should be passed to the person who knows her best, in my opinion. But what I believe is it was given to him to help shape the narrative and control any potential incriminating things said. You'll see more on why I really believe that later, but just stick around. Shortly after this call began around 9:07 a.m., the first officer arrives. Based on info from the crime scene report, the officer had discovered the clothed body of the deceased Tamla lying in the backyard. It noted the time of arrival in the officer report, but none of the other details. But it was noted that the detectives from the Forsyth County Sheriff's Office Major Crime Unit, Crime Scene Investigation, and an investigator from the coroner's office had responded to the scene also. After some investigation from the crime scene, her body was transported to the coroner's office of the GBI for an autopsy. The witnesses that were still around were corroborated with, and the logs of the security system were used to gain knowledge of times the doors were open and closed. It was never mentioned if the camera that Jose had mentioned caught anything, but you'd assume not, since that would obviously give all the info needed. The positioning of her body, as noted, was in a prone position with legs extended straight. Her left arm was seen along the side of her body, and bent at an obtuse angle at the elbow, placing the hand away from the body. Her right arm was extended down the side of the body, and that's exactly how the officer said he observed the body at the time of arrival. The crime scene report also stated that at 11:05 a.m. rigor mortis was present and lividity, which, for those who may not be aware, rigor is a natural thing that occurs within the body of a deceased person that causes joints to stiffen, and lividity is the pooling of blood. This occurs in various different areas of the body depending on the way the body is positioned, and is caused by gravity and your blood collecting in whatever position gravity falls. It often leaves a purplish discoloration on the skin, and it was noted by the coroner her lividity was normal from the position she was found, which for the set amount of time she was discovered and manner, it looks as if she wasn't dragged from that position by anyone, but that doesn't make it less suspicious. Her body suffered multiple injuries, as one can imagine, from a fall, but also some that seemed quite out of place. And as you may remember, a cut on her right wrist that led the 911 dispatcher to question suicide as a possibility. The fall she would have suffered from would have been approximately 14 feet, which doesn't honestly, in my opinion, seem like something that would lead to a fatal injury in a two-story building, especially based on positioning. It seemed like she would have tried to brace for impact or something. Some other wounds suffered from the incident included superficial scratches, blunt force injuries of the head, neck, torso, extremities, and a dislocation of her right wrist. On February 20th of 2019, the investigator came to the conclusion that the injuries were consistent with the fall from the balcony, and placed a call in with Dr. Kuppenmeier of the GPI Medical Examiner's Office to see if he had agreed, to which he did, and it was written off as an accidental death, case closed. But it would soon prove to be weirder. Just a couple weeks before that phone call, neatly tying things up, an incident report would have been filed by a close friend of Tamla, Michelle Graves. As she claimed her private information, such as address of herself, her phone number, and mother's phone number were leaked, along with case information. This incident also followed threats by Jeanne, who was the homeowner, to Michelle, because she was basically asking too many questions and trying to figure out what happened. The potential leaker of this information would be discovered to be none other than the boyfriend of, also said, a homeowner, Jose Barrera, who we heard during the 911 phone call. Due to his position at work, he was able to access these files because he worked as a former pretrial service officer. He was also quickly fired after the investigation, but he vehemently denied having any involvement in the data being leaked back in December of 2018, just barely a month after Tamla's death. The family that Tamla tragically had to leave behind and friends just want answers, and a more thorough investigation that would be given to any person who isn't of color. I think this is a powerful moment we are all in, and I hope that we can bring justice to Tamla's name, along with the countless other victims who don't even have suspects or names yet. I want to leave you guys with a recent letter by the lawyer of Tamla's family. Let it sit with you and continue to fight for others. And if you guys enjoy any of the work that I've done so far on this podcast, it would be incredible if you guys would subscribe, comment, and rate, and let me know what you guys would like to hear next, and I'm hoping we can bring justice to these cases. Dear Leander, 2 weeks ago we finished the exhaustive review of the records related to the investigation into the death of Tamla. I am glad we had an opportunity to conference today with the rest of the immediate family. Hopefully by Tuesday I will have a more detailed analysis, but for today, however, I want to repeat some of what I told you. The review reflects that a homicide is a strong possibility. A potential suspect handled the body as well as the evidence prior to the law enforcement arrival. Evidence was disposed of and no injury followed. The scene was not preserved. Evidence was inappropriately handled. The investigation was compromised by an unauthorized access and disclosure to potential targets and witnesses. A remarkable fact is that there were no photographs taken during the autopsy of Tamla's body. This had to have been done at someone's directive because such a practice is unheard of. Let us address one issue as a sample, in reverse order. From the above, it appears Tamla was involved in a struggle. There were abrasions noted consistent with that scenario. There were parallel scratches to one arm. Since they were fresh, photos would have been proven, but having no photos ensures to our detriment. There was one x-ray, yet the injury noted as the cause of death appears nowhere. Getting the records had been another monumental task, to say the least. I could go on and will. In a few days, Forsyth County Sheriff's Office employees have been the subject of much criticism. The case agent was a close friend of a subject who turned out to be the leak of the ongoing investigation. The town of Cumming has a history which raises eyebrows. After conducting my extensive review, I have come to the conclusion that the truth never had a chance here. Let me conclude by telling you that my years of experience lead me to believe that 80% of cases where African Americans die under mysterious circumstances end up closed or cold because there are no videos and the only witnesses are bad guys or good guys that deep down are really bad. Then you have cases where law enforcement does a poor job and cares little to investigate thoroughly because of some connection or association to the perpetrators. Take the Ahmaud Arbery slaying recently. Without the video servicing and the media, there would have never been an arrest in that cozy relationship between the perpetrators, prosecutors, and the investigators. A rookie lawyer that gets a video in a wrongful death case where a stopped car is rear-ended by a speeding semi will win each time. A video of someone walking up to the bank teller, face uncovered, and firing a gun point blank will most certainly lead to conviction. But those facts are not what we are dealing with here. Here we are fighting an uphill battle because those who wear the badge and were entrusted with the investigatory task failed you. But this is not over. It will never be over. Be safe. Be strong. We will get to the bottom of this. Sincerely, Ralph E. Fernandez.